Apologies, this is Dan Le Batard, that I have made the schedule recently a little bit difficult with South Beach Sessions. We should resume to normal right about now. Carl Hyacin is one of my favorite authors from growing up. There was a heyday at the Miami Herald during the 80s and 90s where so many good journalists came through that place writing so much rich copy about so many different things, and few were braver than this guy. In the middle of it all, Carl Hyacin has a new book out, Assume the Worst, the graduation speech you'll never hear. One of the most difficult things to do is write funny, and he often did that. I wanted to sit down and talk to him a little bit about journalism and some of the things that he's experienced. He lost a brother in a newsroom shooting. The grieving goes on. The grieving will never end. He is really honest on that subject and still wounded, obviously. So we will talk to him about that. But Carl Hyacin, if you do not remember, he wrote the book Striptease. He wrote a number of excellent, funny books, most of them in Miami cartoonish, but not that far from the truth. And Striptease became a movie that wasn't any good, but that book was really good. Burt Reynolds was in that movie.
I tried out for that movie. Final callbacks, Dan. And I got the role, and then Demi Moore changed the role so her daughter can be in it.
Ouch.
Yeah. I wanted to be in a movie with Armand Asante so bad.
Ah. But you were playing a woman?
No, they changed the role. And that, it was a real stretch on my part. Yeah, they really trusted me with it.
Why don't you tell the people about who's sponsoring South Beach Sessions?
Well, I had to try out for this film, but I wish that there was a service like ZipRecruiter.
Yeah.
It would have been a lot easier for me.
Hiring
can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found its new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for all businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BEACH, ZipRecruiter.com/beach. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. With all that being said, Dan, it's great to have you back on South Beach Sessions. It got really weird when Chris Cody had to do a couple of them for you.
We got deep.
Yeah, he interviewed Adam Richman from Man vs. Food.
Talked to him about sauces, yeah.
Yeah, but it's good to have Dan Le Batard back as host of Dan Le Batard South Beach Sessions.
And it is good to have Carl Hyacin, Miami Herald. Here he is. Hello, I'm Dan Le Batard, and at the risk of making this guy a guy I've enjoyed reading since I was a kid feel fossilized, Carl Hyacin, I need you to know that since I was a kid, I was reading what you wrote in the Miami Herald, and what I read was more colorful than I was used to. I don't know how you got away with some of the things you got away with. I didn't really understand journalism at the time. I didn't understand column writing. But you were provocative and funny very fast. And so I'm wondering your backstory. It goes through the Florida Keys. He's got a new book out, by the way, Assume the Worst, the graduation speech you'll never hear. It's available now. And he's one of my favorite writers growing up. Very funny. Writing funny is really hard. So how did it start for you in the Florida Keys, the gravitation toward writing?
Well, I mean, I actually grew up in Plantation when it was in the cow pastures on the edge of the Everglades out there. And I was lucky. My mom had been an English teacher, and we had a lot of books in the house. And I actually started reading, Dan. I mean, I learned to read on the sports page of the Miami Herald, reading Eddie Pope. According to my mother, that's where I first learned to read, because I would read the sports stories to my dad in the morning when he was drinking his coffee. So I loved newspapers from an early age. And I was lucky enough to know that I wanted to write. And then when I got to high school at Plantation High, I started this little sort of an underground newsletter. You know, I was just smart-ass, irreverent. And all the kids that I was afraid of getting beaten up by were reading it, and they liked the humor. I thought, well, this is a good way not to get slugged if I can make them laugh. And that's kind of what I stuck with.
I didn't realize that our stories were similar that way because it was the same thing for me in high school. It wasn't about fights, but I wasn't very popular, and writing about the athletes was really the first thing anyone told me I was any good at, and the athletes found it funny, and so I was able to be more popular with them.
I think a lot of us have something in our background. It was a way to express yourself and be somebody that was closer to your true self than the kid who's, you know, walked around the hall with the book bags and everything. And then I was just lucky. My dad got me a typewriter when I was 6 years old because I loved to write little stories and things then. And I've been very blessed. And of course, the long time at the Herald and then books and all that have been all a wonderful surprise. But it is painful and debasing work at one level. So.
Painful and debasing. That does not sound like the height of joy and laughter.
I think if you talk to Dave Barry about it, too, he would tell you, that, and you said it earlier, that writing when you're supposed to be funny is hard because you don't always feel funny. And I think it's a very tight rope between writing a funny line and writing a terrible flat line that doesn't work. And so you agonize over every adjective and every comma and everything, I think more so than just sort of straight writing. And I mean, you even found this with the columns. There's a little more pressure when people expect to be entertained a certain way. And now it's harder and harder to be funny because at least in a satirical way, because the headlines are funny in and of themselves. They surpass satire on a daily basis in Florida.
Well, you have to be marveling throughout your career at the richness of our area. I mean, your novels were filled with this stuff. Like, we grew up in the most wonderful, shittiest place, Carl, for this kind of writing.
And there's a great irony there, Dan, because I was born and raised down. I mean, I love the place so much, and it's so much what's happened to it horrifies me. But at the same time, it's provided me an income because the angrier I get, the more I write about it. And I think most satire, to be honest with you, comes from sort of a well of anger and sense of injustice. And so all the fuel that has helped my writing, in a way, the weirdness and the depravity and the greed of Florida has enriched me as well. So it's a double-edged sword. But you're right. I mean, I think if you travel around the country, and you do quite a bit, that and you meet people and you say you're from Florida, they want you to sit down and tell circus stories because they can't, you know, they can't relate to it.
Well, you did tell circus stories because the politics gave you such rich soil. I'm curious, when people want to talk to you about your columns for the Miami Herald, how high on the list is the courage that you had to have to continually go after the publisher of the newspaper because he was running for politics and you were calling him Publisher Loco? Like,
yeah.
Where does that rank in terms of columns that people want to ask you about the most?
There was a time in newspapers when you had columnists kind of gentle. And, you know, on the one hand this and on the other hand this. And I thought, no, that's not my personality. And you just sort of called it like you saw them. And, you knew you were pissing people off. And I think it took the Herald management a little while to adjust it. They had approached me about doing the column. And then when you go after people by name, and God knows, you know, Miami. I mean, in those days, as it is now, it was just gloriously corrupt. And they were bad at it. In cities like Chicago and New York and Philly, where graft and bribery had been around for generations and generations, they'd gotten kind of good at it. In Miami, it was just clumsy cash in a bag. You could buy them so cheap, you know, that it would just became, there was a comic aspect to the bribery and the corruption. And I think I just fell into that newsroom at a time when it was, like you said, it was so rich that you couldn't really lose it. It was literally shooting fish in a barrel. And it still is to some extent.
When you say gloriously corrupt, what are the things that you're thinking of in terms of richness of material? Because we're such a banana republic when it comes to this stuff.
Well, I just can't even count on my fingers the number of city and county commissioners that got busted on bribery charges. You had the building of the Miami airport was basically a continuing criminal enterprise, and it's still going on to some extent. I mean, there's just so many things, the court scandals. You know, you had the Santeria sacrifices on the steps of the courthouse. I mean, I don't know if you remember that, where they had to have what they called the voodoo squad come in early before the courthouse opened and clean up the dead chickens and other things were left because the people were putting curses on prosecutors and judges. And I mean, in other city, they look at you like you're madness. But I mean, that stuff really happened. And I think also the drug stuff too, Dan. I mean, because we were there before the Sonny Crockett era of it all. I mean, in the real cocaine wars in the beginning and marijuana before that. you just saw the amount of money and with it the corruption go up a lot. And sadly, police departments, federal police as well. I mean, everything you now see on TV in Narcos, I mean, we lived through that. We wrote about that stuff, the machine gun shootings on the turnpike, that kind of stuff. It was astonishing then. And I was looking back on it now, I still am astonished that it happened.
Is there anything there that you're thinking of in particular? I just saw Confessions of a Cocaine Cowboy, which does a nice job of sort of explaining the history of Miami. And you lived it. You were in the middle of it. I can't think of a more fertile soil for a columnist. How would you explain the cocainey time or the most cocainey time of Miami to people?
I would have to say late 70s, early 80s. And then, you know, where you had the great influx of Colombians who came in to put their own network in place and take it away from the Cuban Americans. And that's when you had the violence break out, and you had every movie cliche, the whole Scarface thing with the guns, with the crazy parties and the mutiny. And I remember Rolling Stone asked me and Al Messersmith to do a story about it when it first started happening. It's interesting how it holds up now as art, not the story, but just what happened is now part, it's ingrained as part of the American criminal culture. It's like you mentioned the documentaries that they used to do on the mafia. It's later, it's Escobar. It's all the guys that our investigative team at the Herald wrote about. One of the funny stories, you know, my mom lived in Plantation until she died a couple of years ago. And after Escobar was killed and they went after all his stuff in the United States, she lived in a, you know, regular residential neighborhood in Plantation. The feds came and they seized a condominium building that Escobar had owned so his wife couldn't claim. She was, his wife, his widow, was trying to get all the stuff he had bought in the United States. And the feds came in, right, Plantation, they grabbed, and it was Pablo Escobar's. It was a condo investment. He was like any other investor. Yeah, that's a good deal.
I'm curious what you make of what's happened to newspapers as someone who loves newspapers, because you're talking about the Miami Herald's heyday. Like when there was a time at the Miami Herald where the columnists were so strong and the news was so strong that you could have made the argument that there wasn't a better newspaper in America.
And because of the place and the time and the talent that was in that newsroom, Dan. I mean, just the people who went through that newsroom to go on to the New York Times and the Post and the Wall Street Journal. Just an astonishing bunch of talent. And what's happened to the Herald is what's happened to newspapers all over the country. I mean, the advertising model changed. The Internet came along. It was already in trouble. Sort of the newspaper subscription and advertising part of it was already failing, but the Internet sort of pushed it over the edge. So now you have many big cities, just a shell of what used to be. And you still have bright people working their butts off. But, you know, you don't have the newspapers, obviously thinner than it ever was, just like magazines are for the most part.
It hurts me to see how flimsy it is. Like, just hurts.
It's agonizing. And here's the thing, and I think you'll agree with me on this. It's a tragedy, and I don't say that because of the number of people who've been put out of work and the fact that the staff is small and everybody's struggling. I say that it's a tragedy for the readers, because what the cost of what's happening in the newspapers is the loss of local news coverage. We can find out whatever we want to find out about what's happening in Syria or what's happening in Washington or New York. But when you don't have enough reporters to put on the street or to send to county commission meetings or a city commission meeting in Hialeah, when you don't have neighborhood coverage, you don't have neighborhood police coverage, the people who are suffering because of the death of newspapers are readers. They're not getting the information they need for their own communities. It's not the big stories. It's the little stories that they need. And it's disappearing all over the country. It's tragic. And I travel quite a bit and I see, I'll go through these airports and I'll pick up, you know, what used to be a big fat newspaper in a town, and it's a joke. And you're thinking, how do the people that live here make any decisions about when you're voting, about your taxes, about zoning, about all these things, when there's not enough reporters to go to the meetings and say what's happening?
And what have you observed as really the entire media climate? Like what you've seen specifically happen in the last couple of years to newspapers, where it seems like the American public isn't believing that media is evil, that it deserves this fate because we're filled with credibility problems. Like what you make of the last 2 years is what?
Well, when I started in newspapers, the year I started was the year Richard Nixon resigned from the White House in the Watergate scandal. That was my first, about 2 months after I became a reporter, he resigned. So, but we had lived through Watergate and we had listened to Nixon and Agnew another crook who and listen to them blast the press for endlessly, not in necessarily the crude or the clumsy way that Trump does. But, I mean, Nixon had his speechwriter do it, and Agnew had speechwriters doing it for him. But it was a constant drumbeat against the network news, you know, and against the big papers, the Times and the Post. I see the other side of this because I remember when Richard Nixon considered the Washington Post public enemy number one because they wrote about him, and everything they wrote turned out to be true, and it was even worse than we thought. So I'm not in a panic like some people are. The difference, I think, Dan, is the press has never been popular. This idea that everybody always loved newspapers and free press, that's always been controversial. If people don't read news they don't want to hear, then they hate the press. So that's nothing new. But the level of rhetoric and the idea that violence is okay against a free press, that's newer, and that's more shocking, and it's more disturbing in many levels, and in my own case, because, you know, I lost my brother in the newsroom shooting up in Annapolis last year, and he was an editor of that paper, and there were five people killed when the gunman went into that paper, and he had a grudge against the paper, this guy. I don't know whatever triggered it on that particular day had anything to do with the rhetoric on the internet, but the idea that you're just going to go shoot a bunch of reporters and editors, that is something new.
You dedicated Native Tongue to your brother, did you not?
Yeah, that was a long time ago. I did. He was a terrific guy, terrific journalist, and a wonderful father and husband, and it was just a horrible thing. And, you know, we'll never get over it. Families don't. You know, you join this vastly growing community of families of mass shooting victims, and it's horrible how many people are out there that you meet that have been touched by these horrible tragedies. But in this case, it's more a concern beyond what happened in my own family, just the idea that some asshole can walk into a newsroom and shortly after Rob was killed, you know, there was credible threats against the Boston Globe staff, and they arrested a guy who had threatened to go in there and mow everybody down. Now, you can say that these sentiments always existed, but we're a much more violent country than we were 30 or 40 years ago, and even during Watergate. There's more guns, there's more nuts with guns, and there's more encouragement. And the rhetoric of hate is much more open. There's no shame to it now. You're on the internet, you can babble anonymously all you want about how you hate Jews and blacks and Muslims. And I mean, it's disturbingly easy to find these kinds of people, and a lot of them are armed. So I think there is a concern that this is closer to the boiling point than it's ever been.
Carl, I don't want to press on anything here that you don't want to talk about, but as it relates to your brother, when you talk about grieving families, how much of that are you willing to share with the audience of the story, the particulars of what this did to your family and specifically the tragedy that it was?
Well, it's indescribable. We've known each other for a while, so I can tell you. I mean, I couldn't really write anything for 2 months. For the first time in my entire career, I was paralyzed with the grief of it. And then also helping my brother's family, you know, try to cope. He had three grown kids and his wife of 33 years. It was her birthday when he was murdered that day. And he left a present for her on the dining room table before he went to work for the last time. And it was still there weeks later. She couldn't. You know, I mean, you hear these stories, and I mean, I know so many people have been through horrible tragedies that can identify with them, but it does, it's a crippling and crushing thing that you don't get over, and I don't know that I'll ever get over it. I know his family will. You just try to bandage and go on, and the only thing that could help me through was I knew that he would want me to keep writing. He would want me to keep doing what I do, keep working on the novels, and keep, you know, banging out the columns once a week. And I mean, he was a pure journalist at heart, and I know it would have broken his heart if he thought what happened to him would make me stop or quit or reconsider what I do and the way I do it. So that's what got me going. And I can't speak for the rest of the family. The kids have all been affected in different ways. I don't care whether you're 9 years old or 19 or 29 to lose your father in that way, in such a public way. To see his face on CNN for 3 or 4 days in a row with the other four victims, you know, over and over again. I mean, it's very difficult to try to cope when it's a crime of that magnitude and it's out there for so long.
How did it change you?
It's a good question, Dan. I don't know. I think it made me a little more, I don't want to say it made me a little more guarded. It didn't change the way I wrote the way I write, but I think it made me a little more conscious of situations to put myself in, because there's so many nuts out there. You know, I don't mean, I'm not paranoid, but I'm a little more alert than I used to be, just to things that don't look right or something letters. You get a letter. You know, I mean, we all get nutty letters if we're in this business. You're just a little more alert and aware of it, I guess. And it's made me, I think, more aware of the ripple effect of these crimes, which I always knew. Rob went to Plantation High the way I did. So that's not too far from Parkland. So after the Parkland shooting, he and I, we were both extremely shaken up and distraught by it. It was so close to home and those kids. You know, I mean, it was just in our backyards, basically, when we were kids. So ironically, we had talked about that. And then only a few months later, it happened to him. It's hard to look at the scars from the outside. I'm sure it's changed me in some way that's never going to get fixed. But
and there's no solace, right? You can't. There's not a solace in, hey, you know, he died a heroic journalist, or
no.
You can't find any. Nothing feels like solace.
No, it doesn't. And here's the thing, Dan. This is all he was doing. He was putting out a community paper in Annapolis, Maryland, and he was in there editing copy for whatever was happening the next day in that town. For those people, and he cared about that. He worked for years for the Baltimore Sun, before that for the Palm Beach Post, and he was doing what 99% of the journalists in this country do. They go in, and what's the lead story on the sports page? What's the lead story on City? It's just the craft and, you know, the basic day-to-day, put out the paper, and that's all he was doing. He was sitting at his desk and sitting next to the op-ed writer. All he was doing was trying to put news and information into the hands of readers, you know, in Annapolis, Maryland. He wasn't doing anything more than that. And yet it's an extremely important job. And people say, well, he just was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I said, no, he was in exactly the place he wanted to be. He wasn't at the wrong time. That's where he was supposed to be. You know, what happened to him is not what's supposed to happen. That's all.
I can't believe that you come from journalism this way and you wouldn't be wounded by the idea that you come from a dangerous place. You've been a fearless writer your entire career, and now in your 60s, you know, because of something horrific that happened to your family, you sound like you're just a little more afraid, and you've never been someone who's afraid in his writing.
No, I don't think the columns have gotten any softer or anything like that. Here's one thing that you learn from this, Dan, and when you see how many other people were hurt by this kind of crime, and my concern for Rob's wife and his kids and my own family, what happens is you start thinking about damage way beyond what would happen to just me. You know what I'm saying? I think it makes you think a little more about family. I've always been a fair, just because the nature of what we did back in the 70s and 80s in the newsroom, you know, the kind of things we had to cover, all the civil disturbances.
Carl, you were going after money. You were going after people's big money. You were going... Like, yeah, you're going after, you don't know what you could write in Miami in the 80s that would bring some hitman to your house.
Yeah, I think because of that, I think I was cognizant of my whereabouts and what, you know, I didn't try to put myself in any risk. And certainly I was not nearly at the same level of risk that the foreign correspondents we have were who are in Central America.
Are you sure, Carl? Are you sure? Because I remember Miami. You're totally positive.
I'm absolutely sure I wasn't. Those folks that went into combat situations, I mean, you know, when Tim Chapman was in Nicaragua with the Sandinistas, and I mean, he got shot down in a helicopter, for God's sakes.
I'm joking. I'm just saying it was a pretty dangerous Miami, too. You were writing fearlessly in a pretty dangerous Miami.
Let me put it like this. I knew what stoplights in town you stopped at, and I knew what stoplights you blew through. Just street stuff. You learn that stuff. But I was never the hero guy, Dan. I mean, I really wasn't. And the investigations team we had with Jim Savage and those, oh, my God. I mean, one of the best in the country. I was so lucky. It helped the novels later because the stuff you absorb and the things you get to see and the people, you know, the bad guys you get to interview and the good guys you get to interview, all of that helps you when creating characters in fiction later. You learn how the world works. You learn the ugly side of it. You learn the better side of it. But as it helps you as a fiction writer to have had that kind of exposure to a city like that at the time we were there. You know, I mean, it really enhances not just your credibility, but your sense of confidence as you write about this stuff. And so I was blessed in a weird way for just being there at that time.
When you started writing, the best case scenario for where your career would end up was what? Like your biggest dreams?
You know what? Yeah.
You've exceeded them, right? You've exceeded whatever it is that you dreamt about.
I tell you what I dreamed when I was little. What I wanted to do was I wanted to grow up and write sports. The Yankees had spring training in Fort Lauderdale. My grandfather would take us to the games. And I thought it was the coolest thing in the world that somebody actually got paid. Sports writers got paid to go to the game. They got to go to the games for free. Then they got to write about the games and put their names on the stories so that everybody else would read about them. I thought that's a
That's why I loved it. That's exactly why I started doing it.
I thought that's got to be the best gig in the world. Absolutely. And then here's what happened when I get to college. I was interning at the Gainesville Sun, I remember, and they had me doing high school sports. You'll appreciate this. So I cover some football game, Buchholz, somebody, and it ends with a kid missing a short field goal and the other team wins. I'd write the story, what, maybe 8 inches, 9 inches, tucked somewhere inside the sports page of the Gainesville Sun. Kid missed a field goal, the other team wins. I'm living in married housing at the time. I have a small kid. The phone starts ringing like 6 in the morning. My phone starts ringing. I pick it up. It's the mother of the kid who missed the field goal saying, "You just ruined my son's life by putting in the paper that he missed that field goal." And I said, would you wanted me to leave his name out if he made the field goal? She goes, "Of course not, but you got to live with what you did. You ruined his life. He's crying. He's screaming." I hung up the phone. I called Southern Bell. And I said, "I want an unlisted number." And I've never had a listed phone number since then, since that crazy mom called me up. And I said, "And here's the other thing. I'm done with sports writing."
That's it. You quit on the spot. These people are too crazy for me. I'm going back to just, gloriously corrupt Miami. These sports lunatics.
I would rather have Pablo Escobar calling me than an angry teenage sports mom.
And so what did you dream of from there, though? What did you think? So the big dream was not novels, right? Was it?
Well, I always wanted to write, but no, I wasn't novel. I wanted to just work for newspapers. And then I started when I was in college, first at Emory and then Florida. I worked on a couple novels as a ghostwriter, and they both got published. And so that gave me some confidence. And then when I got to Miami, the Herald, and I started working with Bill Montalbano, who was a great foreign correspondent. He was an editor of mine at the paper. So we did like 3 novels together that were thrillers. One was based on the cocaine wars. One was based on marijuana smuggling and the key stuff that I'd written about and had done projects on. And one was set in China, where Bill was one of the first foreign correspondents to go to Beijing. So we just ripped stuff out of our own reporters' notebooks and wrote these sort of traditional thrillers, and they all got published, and they all got good reviews. And it was like, and at the time, you know what the truth is, we needed a little extra money, too. We both had families, and we thought, we'd make a little extra money writing books, and then it just turned into something great. But I never dreamed, to answer because no, I never dreamed in a million years, first of all, that I'd still be writing a column at the Miami Herald when I walked in the door in 1976. I'd never dreamed I'd still be doing it, and I never dreamed I'd have the success with the books and all that. And no, of course not. I'm one of the luckiest son of a bitches I've ever known.
What do you regard as the greatest time at the Miami Herald? Like, if you had to take any 1, 5, or 10-year span where you were proudest to work at the paper because the journalism was hungry and rich.
78 through 88, when the paper was, they had the big investigation teams going on. They were fearless. We had bureaus all over the place. We had big teams. We would have sometimes 2 investigations, sometimes more going on at once. If something happened, if a plane went down somewhere in Pennsylvania, the Herald had reporters on a plane to go up there to write about it. Like where Air Florida went down in Washington, Gene Miller was there within 8 hours. Those are things you did because the papers had money. They were making huge amounts of money, big fat ads, you know, and all advertisement. It was just a different world, Janet. I mean, that doesn't really exist anywhere anymore except with maybe the Times or the Washington Post or the Journal, who are extremely popular and have good big readerships. But most papers don't have big investigative teams anymore. Many of them have no investigative team. Many of them have no art section, no book section. No style section is maybe 1 page. You know, all this has disappeared with the change of the business model of journalism. And again, to the detriment of readers, the readers are the ones that are missing out. There's still a great demand for content, obviously, because the Internet. I mean, we still need writers. We still need journalists. But the way that all of it's being delivered is so different that I just miss those days when the paper landed on your your doorstep, and you could hear it. You know, it sounded like a cord of firewood landing in the driveway. It was so big. And now, wouldn't kill a June bug if paper landed on him and I get thrown out of a car.
Carl, I'm going to tell you a true story. This is a true story. I've told it before on the radio, but it didn't happen that long ago to a friend of mine who still reads the Sunday paper. His 10-year-old comes in with a friend of his while he's reading the Sunday paper. And the friend says to Andrew, his son, "What is that? What is that that your father has in his hands?" And wait. It gets better. And so my friend begins to explain to him, well, it's a chronicling of the day's events. It tells you everything that's going on. And he starts to explain it. And then the kid asks the perfect question. How did it get here? And when my friend explained to the kid that someone had thrown it in the bushes, he was like, oh, now you're shitting with me. Now, clearly, this is what? Somebody drove by the house and threw it in the lawn? Like,
oh, my God. You're breaking my heart, man.
It is. But it's a bummer, right? I mean, it has to be, because I know it makes me sad. I know it must make you sad as someone who, like, really cared about and still care what it is.
I care about the craft and the civic duty. And when I listen to people badmouth, oh, the media, most of it's just complete bullshit. They just don't like what they read. Get used to it, because that's what a lot of news is. But if you live on a street and you're out there in your front yard with your kid, let's say you're throwing a baseball around, and a police car goes flying down the street, and then an ambulance goes flying down the street, and you're standing, you watch them go by, what's going through your head? What's happening? What's going on? It's a natural human impulse to that interest in news. Okay, is it my name? Somebody I know? Did somebody get robbed? Did somebody get hurt? Where do you go for that information? That's the basic element of news is, this happened, you need to know about it. And it goes all the way up to, you know, 9/11. It goes up through what's going on now in Washington. But at a local level, it's really basic. You're riding your bike with your kid, you turn a corner, you ride down the street, and all these trees are gone, and there's a sign up that says there's a new Walmart going up in a month. And you didn't know anything about it because there was nothing in the paper, because nobody's covering the zoning board, and nobody covered the vote from the county commission. And welcome to your neighborhood. You got a big box store going in. And you got that because the newspaper that used to cover it can't cover it anymore. Doesn't have enough people.
But it doesn't seem, though, Carl, like this is that new, because the idea that there is no such thing as the trusted news anchor anymore, that 10 years ago, the most trusted news anchor as voted by the United States of America was the comedian Jon Stewart. Like,
That's right.
Like, all of this stuff changed on our watch, changed over the last 15 years.
Very much so. And a lot of it is the internet. A lot of it is the way cable changed the news presentation on TV. You know, just the sheer number of outlets. There's so much that can't undo, and you can't make it. And maybe you don't want it to go back the way it was, but there's still the basic tools of gathering facts, and there's still supposedly basic integrity about the truthiness, as Colbert would say, of what you report and what you write. And there's so much crap on the internet. Some of it is just an IQ test. Some of it is Darwinian. If you're going to believe that Hillary Clinton was running a pedophilia racket out of a pizza parlor, then you're a drooling moron, if you believe that. You really are. You're a troglodyte.
I love it when you get pissed off. I really do.
There are thousands of people that will believe any horse shit that sounds good to them. And you can't help those people. Those people.
Pissed off Carl Hyacin is the best Carl Hyacin.
I'm serious. They're congenitally doomed to be ignorant, and they prefer it that way, and they prefer to be told rather than learn. They prefer to be told what to think and how to act and how to vote. That's their nature. That's just their pathetic, lazy nature. And there's nothing you can do about those people. But you can patrol hate speech and speech that encourages violence against innocent people. All that you can't control idiots, but you can, if you're Facebook or Instagram and these others, have some programs in place that prevent bad people, don't encourage bad people to do violent things. There is a line that has to be maintained there. You know, I don't care if some guy's sitting in his underwear in a basement in Iowa viewing conspiracy theories saying that the Sandy Hook shootings never happened. I mean, it's one thing to be that stupid. It's another thing to name the names of the parents of those children and encourage people to harass them online and say that the children aren't really dead or that they're crisis actors. Or to harass, some of these parents of the Sandy Hook kids have had to change their phone numbers, move, hide, because of the harassment from these cretins. That's where the line is drawn, and that's where society cannot tolerate that kind of venom.
Have you found these grieving groups to be helpful, like the connection points where people can feel less alone?
I haven't been active. My sister-in-law has been more active than I have, but she's been more involved politically on it. I have tried to keep somewhat of a professional distance, and I'm not a joiner, as you know, and I don't think many journalists are. I think whatever works for people, they should try to do. I think the Parkland kids have been heroic and amazing and have fought back to some of this internet bile and held their own quite well against it. I'll give you one example. When my brother was killed, and the next day, his wife was courageous enough to go on a CNN reporter in front of their house, had stopped her, and she talked to CNN about losing Rob. And, you know, she was somewhat in a daze, you can imagine. And within minutes on the internet, there were people saying, well, she's a crisis act. This didn't happen. And I watched her with my own eyes, with tears, watching her trying to tell the world what a great guy my brother was. And then these assholes, these guys with fungus in their toes, sitting in their bathrobes in the bottom of some basement, doing that kind of stuff. So that's out there.
When you write Assume the Worst, the graduation speech you'll never hear, it's available now. And I don't have a way to segue from what we were just talking about into the promotion of your latest work.
Oh, well.
But if people want to read what it is that you have done here, what would you tell them was the motivation of what you're trying to do with this book?
My youngest is getting ready to go off to college. When I wrote that, I have other family members who were, and I have grandkids who are getting ready to go off to college now. I had just seen enough and heard enough graduation speeches. You know, journalists do not tend to be the sunniest, most optimistic, upbeat people. And I heard enough cliches about do your best, you can be anything you want to be. Well, it's just not true. You can't be anything you want to be. Stop telling your kids they can be anything. They can't. I was never going to grow up to be Michael Jordan. As much as I would have loved to play basketball, it was never going to happen. So you're not doing your kids any favor by deluding them. On the other hand, you can encourage them. So I just wanted to write a common sense graduation speech that they would never, ever let me give about what the real world was like. And as I said, it is a shit blizzard that you're going to have to walk through at times, and you'll be okay. But know your limitations. Know what you want to do. Don't sweat a lot of stuff. I was sort of the anti-graduation speech. I was just so tired of hearing this. Yes, yes. Look at me. This is where I came
from. Enough with your positivity. Enough.
Yeah, enough. If I can do it, you can do it. You know, that's just not true. I'm sorry. That's horseshit. If just because you did it doesn't mean I can do it. I was never going to be Steve Jobs. That's never going to happen.
Well, let me ask you this, though. What were you going to be if I tell you, if I go right back to the time where Carl Hiaasen is at the height of his success? Let's just say it's when Demi Moore is making a movie out of his book, Striptease. If I take you back to that time and I say, Carl, where is this movie? And right now, where is your life about to go from this point forward? You permitted yourself stars in the eyes there, did you not?
No, I did not. That's the truth, Dan. You know, this is the Norwegian gene. Is that there's never a sunny side to anything. And then I just thought, well, this is it. This is the height of it right here. This is just going to get. There's Demi, and you know, I was on the set for a couple of days, and she's dancing, and there's Burt Reynolds. I thought, okay, this is fun. But the fact is, I had to get in the car, drive back to the newsroom and work and write, and I wanted to do it. And it wasn't like I'm going to go to Hollywood. No, hell no. I thought, well, this is fun, and hey, the check cleared, so what the hell? And I'll go write another book, and I'll keep writing for the newspaper. I never had those stars in my eyes. Norwegians don't get stars in their eyes. We get ulcers, man.
Well, yeah, it's not just that, though. Journalists, it doesn't sound like. You're only allowed to be so hopeful because your cynical side is always going to have to show. Hell, if Assume the Worst doesn't speak to that, the graduation speech you'll never hear. Like, that is a brooding, dark undercurrent.
It is, but here's the thing, though. If you calibrate your expectations and you say, okay, it would be great if that happened. It's probably not going to happen. And then if it does, you're over the moon. You say, hey, God, it happened to me. That's great. If it doesn't, you say, I told you it wasn't going anywhere. And you have enough ups and downs in any career. All of us who've been in this business long enough have been up and down enough to, you know, you're really only feeling as good as the last thing you wrote or the last show you did, you know. And you know that some are better than others. And I know that when I write a column, you know, whether it's that's something I'm okay, that's a pretty good one. Or, nah, man, I just didn't pull it off on that one. you know, you're your own worst and toughest critic. Creative people are. That's what makes them get better. I distrust any writer who says, "God, did you read my last book? It's the best thing I ever wrote." Right away, I don't trust the guy one bit.
Carl, I've been a big admirer of your work for a long time, so I love that you're still doing it. If you want to support the people who are entertaining you around here, and this guy's been entertaining Miami for about 40 years, Assume the Worst, the graduation speech you'll never hear. It is available now. He's very funny, and writing funny is hard. And we didn't have a whole lot of funny in this conversation. Jesus, Carl, I'm telling people you're funny. These newcomers, these young people who might not know who you are, I'm telling them you're funny, and we went all dark and Norwegian.
I'm sorry about that, man.
Carl, I appreciate your time. Always good catching up with you. Thank you, buddy.
Thank you, Dan. Take care.
So I told you we'd resume the normal schedule after being off, but we're off next week because of Thanksgiving week, so forgive the lie. What you should check out, though, is many of the things that the Lebatard and Friends Network, including Mystery Crate. It is the thing that is closest to our radio show, where the shipping container surprises you every week with something that's a little different. What do you guys want the people to know about the Mystery Crate?
Well, we want them to check out the entire archive, because these are fairly evergreen episodes for the most part. You'll occasionally hear something that won't make sense if you listen back to it, but please go ahead and support what we do on Mystery Crate. There's a lot of evergreen stuff there for you. It's all the banter that you know and love, but actually it's identical to the local hour in almost every single way.
Yeah. Probably way too much Greg Cody, but it's still good. We talk food.
Yeah, we do interviews on that episode, on those shows, where we don't really talk to people. I know we're supposed to have Will Manso on every Wednesday, and Chris Cody hasn't booked him in like 7 weeks. But please, subscribe to Mystery Crate, because it's a labor of love.
I'm so down on your father right now, Chris. I told you at the wedding, and I mean it sincerely from the depths of my heart. Your father has been drinking for 50 years, half a century, and he hasn't gotten any better at it.
Completely fair. Honestly, we saved him, though, on Saturday. We got him out of there.
He was sideways. Your mom was carrying him out of the place again. She's been doing that for 40 fucking years.